Public, good afternoon and welcome to State and Local Government Committee. Senator Marty, welcome to our committee. You have Senate File 1432. We don't have a quorum yet, but we could. We typically have members around,
right.
Senator, as you know, and they will be coming in. So as soon as we have a quorum, I will announce it.
Thank you.
But we can start with your testimony, if you could call your testifiers, sure. And proceed to present Senate File 1432.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 1432 is the Pollution Control Agency's policy bill and has a number of fairly modest changes. I'll have Mr. Assistant Commissioner Kadelka go through the ones that relate here to rulemaking process and so on. And when you have a quorum, we also have an A2 amendment, which is part technical and partly a bill that of Senator Ingebrigtsen's that just passed out of our committee yesterday that we would like to add in here. It has rulemaking provisions in it, and the bill is now coming to, if it isn't here yet, in your committee, but we would like to add that A2 amendment on it when you do have a quorum present. And with that, I'll turn it over to Deputy or Assistant Commissioner Kadelka to go through provisions that relate to rulemaking or of other interest to this committee.
Welcome, Commissioner Kadelka. Again, we are only going to be covering Section 1 and 9 during this committee, so if you could please offer your remarks.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm an assistant commissioner there. And I just really quickly will do a brief overview of the bill that related to the two sections that Tara just talked about. Section 1 changes the recycled content of publicly entities of purchasing. Currently, it's at 10%. The national and industry average is at 30%, and this bill is really bringing up the state on copy paper recycled content to that of the federal government and what others are doing. There's one mill in Minnesota that makes recycled content paper, Boise Outer National Falls, and they make the 30% content paper. So this would not affect any changes within the paper industry. The other item is Section 9 of the bill dealing with rulemaking. It's connected to Sections 2 and 3 of the bill. It deals with a change we're making with septic system law regarding a building sewer. Really quick, a building sewer is the pipe connected to the house to the septic system, and we are trying to streamline the process for septic professionals in getting their licenses. So instead of going to two different agencies, they go to one. And the expedited rulemaking process that's in Section 9 of the bill is requested is to make those changes that we're making in statute in the bill as soon as possible and conform with the bond requirements of the plumbing code into the septic code. The goal is to do this by the fall because once the calendar year turns, a number of septic professionals will be coming back before the agency to get their new licensures and certificates and bonding, and we would like the new process, streamlined process, in place by then, which is why we're asking for the expedited process. Madam Chair, committee members, I could talk about the A2 amendment. There are two rulemaking things there, if you're interested, or I can wait until you move the amendment.
We do have now a quorum, and so, Senator Marty, you could offer the amendment. I need a member to move it on your behalf. So Senator Pappas moves the A2 amendment on your behalf. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Please proceed to explain the amendment.
Madam Chair and committee members, the two changes you'll see are starting on lines 1.22 and then 1.32. Both of these are changes with the septic systems. I'll start with the latter, Section 11. This is a Senator Ingebrigtsen bill that the agency has worked with the campground resort industry on to help with determining when a permit, a state permit versus a county permit, is needed. As you can see, there's a number of pieces of things that we would like to change in rulemaking, in the rule. Going through a full rulemaking would take close to 18 months or 2 years. The goal is to get this in place right away so that we can provide the regulatory relief that is sought here, and that's why this is the request for the expedited rulemaking process. The other piece, the new Section 10, also asks for expedited rulemaking process. This is a situation with septic professionals and making it in a case where a professional may not have had their continuing education in the appropriate amount of time. Currently, their license lapses, and they are not allowed to work until they finish their continuing education and the proper exams. What we're asking to do in this rulemaking is real quick to change that so that a septic professional has 1 year on a probational license to be able to continue their continuing education and exam so that they can still work during that time, and we also still make sure we have a highly trained septic professional out in the field. Madam Chair and committee members, if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Members, do you have any questions for Senator Marty or his testifier? Any comments? If not, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1336, excuse me, 1432. Senate File 1432 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the floor. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Next in the agenda, we have Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1136. So the Senator, I don't know if he's here. If he isn't, we're just, I don't know if Senator Jensen is here. I think the staff needs to call. Members. If not, we will move to Senator Eaton. You're here.
I'm here.
Fast. You got to do this. You know, there are members who are just moving from committee to committee, so if you would like to proceed with your Senate File 1786, we will do that.
I was voting yes.
Got it? Senator Eaton?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You have Senate File 1786.
I do. The gambling provision modifications. And I also have an amendment that Ms. James has labored over.
Okay. Senator Eaton has the A4 amendment. A1, excuse me, is the A1 amendment. Is it the packet? Oh, no, it's being distributed. If you could just give us a minute for distribution, and then we will move it. Okay, so Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment.
Okay, good.
All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Eaton.
I will let my testifier here walk through the bill with the amendment.
Mr. Lund, if you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alan Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota. This bill addresses some issues, such as the first issue is the ability to have an interim gambling manager. If a charity, their gambling manager is not able to perform their duties, a gambling manager from another charity with the approval of the Gambling Control Board and approval of both those charities can fill in for 120 days while they look for and train a new gambling manager. This will help us to keep charities that want to stay in business, and that's been, and the Gambling Control Board is in lockstep with us on that. We're asking for the use of a device called a random number generator for raffles. Today, raffles are all done by paper, where you take all the slips, throw them into a bucket, you draw out a name, a number. The random number generator, it would be done by computer, and these would need to be approved by the Gambling Control Board, and the charities would still have the option of doing manual or by using a computer to pick the numbers. We're asking for a clarification on raffles. Currently today there's a raffle called a 50-50 raffle, where if you take in $500 worth of tickets, you draw the name and they get 250, the charity gets 250. There is now a version called Share the Pot, where the expenses are deducted before they split the pot, and again, that the charities would need to specify which of these that they're using. So there's total clarity with the people that are participating. We're asking for an increase in bingo game and session prize limits, going from $200 to $500 per game, if that's what the charities are looking to do. And then with the use of a coverall game, the total session dollars would go from $3,800 to $7,000. And then last is the cities today are allowed to take 10% of the net profits of the charities. And if this bill goes through, they would be required to acknowledge where that money came from. And we worked with the League of Cities on that, and we're also all in agreement on that. And that would be, we think that's would be a very good move. So, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, this is not expanding gambling at all, is it?
No. Okay. Madam Chair, no, this is not expanding.
And to our testifier, if I remember, Pheasants Forever was asking to put something in this. Was that ever incorporated, or do you know what happened with that?
Mr. Long.
Madam Chair, I'm going to refer to Tom Baird of the Gambling Control Board, if I may.
Welcome to our committee. If you could please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Tom Baird, Director of the Gambling Control Board. Senator, with reference, it wasn't Pheasants Forever. It was actually Ducks Unlimited.
Yeah,
another
thank
great
you.
Group. But
and that's
no, that's okay. That's okay. I'm happy to report that we're continuing in our dialogue that related to their wishes to expand the exempt raffles and taking
right.
it to a different level. We think we found some solution. Senator Scalzi is sponsoring our bill. We're actually working with the industry in terms of a possible amendment to the finance bill.
Right.
So it's in the works. I think we can find what is a piece in the valley, but it's not in this bill.
Good. Okay. That's what I want to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions, members? Any other comments? If not, Senator Eaton, you can move your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that the more important part to me was we have a shortage of managers for these nonprofit gambling organizations, and this allows some interim managers and some managers who are managing more than one organization at a time for a short period of time. So with that, I would like to move Senate File 1786 as amended to pass and
refer to the floor.
And go to the floor.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Senator Hoffman, I believe we are ready for you now. You have Senate File 1136. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1136 relating to accessibility signs and digital media modification, also known as Hope's Bill. It's been a privilege to work on this important legislation with my daughter, Hope Hoffman, who is with me at the table today. But members, thank you for that opportunity. We all know that words and images matter. They're descriptive, have meaning, and are full of intended and often unintended consequences. We also know that so often our self-image can be impacted positively and negatively by those same words and the images. 25 years ago, the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibited discrimination against people with disabilities in employment, transportation, public accommodation, communications, and governmental activities. The ADA also established requirements for telecommunications relay services. Really, for the first time, the move toward people-first language had been acknowledged and formalized by the ADA Act. Change is underway, and change did happen and must continue. Even some of the language of 25 years ago is needing change today as we continue to build people-first way of speaking. In 2005, Madam Chair, legislation was passed by the legislature ordering that signage be changed to get rid of old, inappropriate, and hurtful words such as handicapped, disabled, and more. It is wrong to refer to people in these terms, and we all know it. The new laws in 2005 have not been enforced. 10 years later, and still, this still needs to change. When my daughter Hope brought this to me, she was hurt and angry that in the modern age she and others were still confronting with those terms. I challenged her to work on this and do something about it. And it started with first a letter, no response from the letter, and then secondly I said, write a bill, which she did. So, Madam Chair, we've worked with the Department of Administration in the preparation of this bill and have conferred with the League of Minnesota Cities, a Minnesota Department of Human Rights, as well as Governor's DD Council and other interested parties. I know there will be a fiscal note, but it's not completed until after today's hearing, as this is the bill policy's last stop. Thus, Hope's bill, Senate File 1136, is before you. I want to thank Hope for her commitment, persistence, and diligence to a rightful cause. I'll stand for questions, but with that, I want to turn the testimony over to Hope. Madam Chair, this is my daughter, Hope.
Welcome to our committee. We are incredibly proud that you're here, and we just look forward to hear all of this engagement in this process and how did you arrive to this. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Hope Hoffman. I briefly want to express this crucial need for language change. Handicap, cap in hand, references a time in old England when war veterans would come back with disabilities. Being denied employment, they were then forced to beg on the streets for money with a cap handy in their hand. Handicap. The word disabled is synonymous with broken down, incapable, and powerless. I was born with spina bifida and am none of those adjectives. New York State legislator has passed a similar legislation, 8193/6846, ridding their state of the word handicap. The move towards people-first language needs to happen, saying people with disabilities and not disabled people, acknowledging an individual's personhood prior to their inabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Hope, could you tell us a little bit about where you are in your career and what do you want to pursue next? Obviously, politics should be part of that plan, but...
I'm currently a senior in the STEP program through Anoka Hennepin. I'm planning on attending Aveda in the fall for S-theology, and advocacy in politics will for sure be a part of my future plan.
We are very happy about that. Members, do you have any questions? Do you have any comments? Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman and Hope, you know, it's so interesting. I've said it before, and I'll say it today especially, that the education that we get around here is really something to be pleased with. And your discussion about the word handicap and disabled was good information for me, and I presume others would also feel that way. And thank you. Did a great job.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Senator Hoffman, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Of course, so much more that we need to do with respect to this. You have been a strong advocate for these issues for many, many, many years. And we appreciate that you are bringing our attention to this and obviously that you have a wonderful companion to really talk about these important issues. Members, if not, if you don't have any other comments or questions, I need somebody to move the bill on behalf of Senator Hoffman. Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1136 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All of those in favor, to finance, excuse me. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. Thank you for the nomination, and I appreciate this work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Senator Jensen, Senate File 383. Senator, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 383 is a bill that has to do with the licensing of optometrists and some changes to the board for optometry. I think for this committee, the area that you would be interested in is in Section 9 and deals with the rulemaking authority for the Board of Optometry. This bill, we worked on it last year. It made it through the process in the Senate but did not make deadline in the House. So this has gone through a couple times in the last couple years. So I have someone with me, Randy Snyder, that would like to talk about it just a little bit.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. And again, members, we are on page 10, or the rulemaking authority, which is the only part that we will talk about during committee. Welcome to our committee, if you could please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Snyder, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Optometry. And you are correct. The only item that we're here today is to talk about the rulemaking that grants us the authority to look at rules specific to this section. So the board is not actively engaged in rulemaking right now. For any section, we may open our rules in a couple of years. But for now, it's just granting us authority for Section 9, which is the reporting obligations currently used by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. And it's the same system to report a doctor, as many optometrists are now included in healthcare systems. There is no opposition to the bill, and this is merely to grant authority for rulemaking.
And Madam Chair, the work done by the board, it's been about 5 years that they've worked on this and incorporated a lot of things. And as far as like the fee section of this bill, it hasn't changed for 27 years. So this is long overdue. They worked really hard, and I really look forward to moving this bill forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for your work, Senator Jensen. Members, do you have any questions for the senator or her testifier? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? If not, Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 383 be recommended to pass and sent to finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Next, we have Senate File 417, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair.
Senator, we are ready for you.
Yes, thanks. Members, Senate File 417, let me give you a little description of the legislation. Before that, I do have an A2 amendment I'd like to move at this time.
Senator Dahl moves the A2 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Society of Professional Engineers, and it addresses some concerns they have regarding the need to obtain multiple licenses or certifications. Professional engineers are already required to obtain a license in order to practice engineering, and that license has a very high standard. The concern the engineers have is the fact that state agencies often establish licenses or certifications that are intended to allow non-engineers to practice a particular type of engineering. In most cases, the knowledge and skills required covered by these licenses or certifications are already covered by the professional engineering license, therefore requiring engineers to obtain these additional license or certifications is not necessary. So the bill establishes the professional engineering license satisfies the requirements of any state agency or local government to practice engineering and will minimize the number of additional licenses or certifications that engineers need to obtain. However, the bill will also allow state agencies or local governments to require engineers to obtain an additional license or certification if they establish that it's necessary to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. The engineers have also reached out to various state agencies to get their input, and that's what the A2 amendment addresses. The A2 amendment addresses clarifications that we felt were needed based on comments by the agencies. The amendment clarifies that the affirmative determination whether a new license or certification would apply to a licensed professional engineer would be a written determination in the statute, rule, or ordinance that establishes the new license or certification. The amendment also clarifies that this bill would not undo any current requirements where licensed professional engineers are already required to obtain an additional license or certification. So this bill would only apply to newly created licenses or certifications established after the effective date. If that sounds very technical to you, it is to me as well. I will turn it over to Brian Malm, principal engineer at Bolton & Mink.
Mr. Malm, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, as Senator Dahl mentioned, my name is Brian Malm. I'm a licensed professional engineer, and I'm here today representing the over 1,000 members of the Minnesota Society of Professional Engineers. We're obviously here to speak in support of the bill. As Senator Dahl mentioned, this bill addresses a concern that we have regarding the need to obtain additional licenses or certifications above and beyond the professional engineering license. As Senator Dahl mentioned, we believe the professional engineering license is a very high standard. To illustrate that, I'll explain what we're required to do to obtain that license. To become licensed, engineers must obtain a bachelor's degree from a four-year accredited engineering program, then pass an eight-hour comprehensive exam. Following that exam, we're required to work for 4 years under a licensed professional engineer, and then take another eight-hour comprehensive exam prior to becoming licensed. Once we're licensed, we're required to obtain 24 hours of continuing education every two-year licensure period. So again, we feel that the license is a very high standard and that it's more than adequate to ensure that engineers are fully qualified to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public while practicing engineering. The Senator also mentioned that we had done outreach to various state agencies to determine whether they had concerns with the bill or not. Those agencies we reached out to included the Pollution Control Agency, Department of Health, Department of Labor and Industry, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Transportation, Department of Administration, and we also reached out to the League of Minnesota Cities. Any of the concerns that we heard from those agencies or groups have been addressed in the bill language or in the author's amendment. Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for Senator Dahl or for his testifier? If not, is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? Senator Dahl, if you could move your motion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 417 as amended. Be recommended to pass.
Sent
referred
to finance.
Finance.
To the floor.
Finance.
To the floor.
To the floor.
Okay.
Floor is better.
To the floor. Yes, it goes to the floor.
To the floor, Madam Chair.
Thank you. On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Next, we have Senate File 1828. Senator Reinhart, welcome to our committee. Everybody wants to put an H in Senator Bonoff's last name. And she always say that she doesn't have an H in her name. And I always want to put an H in your name,
Madam Chair,
your last name, Senator.
I was going to say I have the same challenge. Well, thank you,
so
Madam Chair.
Welcome to our committee.
Members of the committee, I have with me two testifiers to talk about Senate File 1828. Members, you'll notice that this is actually a resolution because we are making a request of the federal government regarding the Officers Club at Fort Snelling. So, Madam Chair, if it pleases you, I would invite the two testifiers just to make some comments about what we're trying to do and why this is needed.
Absolutely. Welcome to our committee. You have some beautiful pictures for us too, Senator. So please proceed to identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kenneth Beal. I come to you with the credentials of having served for 25 years in the United States Army as a commissioned officer. In addition to that, having been myself a member of the Fort Snelling Officers Club for the past 12 years, and likewise, as I see you looking at some of those photographs, it's been my pleasure the last 15 years to be the pastor at the Fort Snelling Memorial Chapel, where services are held on a weekly basis. We're very grateful for this opportunity to have opportunity to talk about this, which largely grew out of a fellowship time that took place at the chapel in our fellowship hall, where Representative Cindy Pugh overheard a conversation about the officers' club being closed. I would just give you in terms of background to what I know the most about as the Fort Snelling Chapel, but it does correlate and have a relationship to the officers' club. It was built between 1927 and 1928 by the Army Corps of Engineers. And it was built for a whopping, brace yourself, a whopping $43,000 back then. It was built by what is known as the 3rd Infantry Regiment. That is the oldest continuous unit in the United States Army. They, at one time, they started out serving under a fellow named General Washington and continued to serve and was responsible for not only the building of the chapel, but also of the in-questioned officers' club. Well, that chapel stayed functioning up and through World War II, where I'm told that there was a bride walking down the aisle of the chapel every 20 minutes, tying the knot with an American GI who was about to deploy for the war. And one of the more well-known who were married at the chapel was General Vesey, General John Vesey, who many of you certainly know, rose to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Reagan administration. Well, in 1946, the active army left Fort Snelling, and the 3rd Infantry assumed its new responsibility at Fort Myer, Virginia, affectionately known as the Old Guard, being that oldest unit. They are the ones that guard the Tomb of the Unknowns. And to think that they were responsible for the building of the chapel and having been there, stationed there, as well as of the officers' club. Well, the chapel, and this is what we don't want to see happen in terms of the officers' club, sat from 1946 to 1966 in disrepair and non-use. It was being vandalized, broken into, and MnDOT had some plans for some new highways to come into the area, but fortunately there was a group of concerned citizens who didn't want to see that chapel torn down by the wrecking ball, and so they organized themselves for the crazy name of our congregation, Fort Snelling Memorial Chapel Foundation, a 501c3 to save the building from the wrecking ball. And for the last 48 years, we've been hosting services. It's managed by the DNR. They are the ones that got that piece of property. It's literally an island on the cloverleaf of the highways, and you have to cross a bridge to get to the chapel site. But our chapel foundation, 48 years, has been renting it to host services so as to maintain that chapel in many ways, and also contributing hundreds of thousands of dollars to the maintenance and well-being of the chapel. Now, how does that tie to the what's in question, the officers' club? I would say to you, first of all, we consider them a neighbor. Anything on the Fort Snelling complex is a neighbor to the Fort Snelling Chapel. And we are pleading for their recognition, like the chapel has, of that of a historic site, so that it has recognition in that capacity. I trust you know, fast approaching in the year 2020 is the bicentennial of Fort Snelling. Now, Minnesota doesn't have much yet to boast in bicentennial terms, but Fort Snelling is one of the earliest establishments, with the round tower being the oldest structure in the state of Minnesota, then the territory of Minnesota. So we certainly have feel a kindred spirit to the officers' club and just can't imagine the coming bicentennial without the presence of the officers' club. I would just merely say to you, in relationship to that whole complex at Fort Snelling, if I may use the analogy of a three-legged stool, I would say to you that one leg of that stool is the chapel. It's in relationship to the historic frontier fort. Another leg of that three-legged stool is the National Cemetery, the third busiest national cemetery in the country, and of great significance. And right between it and a critical role in that stool is the Officers' Club, which is the site for many wedding receptions, funeral family gatherings following an interment at the National Cemetery, And I and others are here to see whatever we can do is to keep that historic site. So subject to your questions, I would be followed by Jim Johns, who is beside me, to give you some further insight on some of the history that exists in this building in question, the Officers Club.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jones, welcome.
Madam Chair,
to our committee.
Members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Captain Jim Johns, U.S. Army Aviation, retired. I joined the Officers Club in 1962, and between deployments and such, I've been probably one of the older members of that club. I'd just like to touch bases on some of the things that have gone on, some of the personages and groups that have graced that club. First off, the club was built in 1934. And at that time, it was known as the Fort Snelling Officers Country Club. There was an outdoor swimming pool, a nine-hole golf course, and outdoor horseback riding, now all buried under the freeway that goes by the club. It's been said that at least three presidents ate at that club: President Truman, President Eisenhower, and the senior President Bush before he became president. This bill is numbered 1942, the House bill. That rings to me the fact that in February of 1942, all of the 80 members of the Doolittle Raiders ate their meals in that club for the better part of 30 days while they were waiting for their B-25 medium bombers to be modified with long-range fuel tanks across the field by Mid-Continent Airlines, today's Sun Country, for what was known at the time as a virtually unbelievable 2,000-mile nonstop flight across enemy territory in the first bombing of the Japanese mainland. They lost all 16 aircraft, but ironically, they saved the better part of 90% of their people. It's been the reunion of the General George S. Patton 4th Armored Division. These were the tankers that turned the German thrust around that was aimed at splitting the Allied armies in December of 1944, in what became known as the Battle of the Bulge. It has been the reunion of the World War II glider pilots. Who were the glider pilots? The glider pilots were virtually unknown today because they had the highest attrition rate of any U.S. organization during the war. These were the guys that flew unarmed troop transports delivering infantrymen at night far behind the enemy lines and landing on fields that no one in their right mind would land on during daylight hours. It was the site of a number of reunions of the USS Ward. If you recall, the Ward was a destroyer that fired the first shot and sunk a submarine outside the entrance to Pearl Harbor 1 full hour before the Japanese attacked. 80 members of the 120-member crew were reservists from the Twin Cities area, a naval reservist from the Twin Cities area. And if you recall, that 5-inch gun that fired that shot is today gracing the Capitol grounds here. If you haven't seen it, it's worth it. It's a piece of history. Some of the personages that have had dinner at one time or another in that club: Paul Tibbetts. Tibbetts dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, August 6, 1945. Fred O'Leary. He dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki 3 days later that convinced the Japanese to throw in the towel on World War II. General John Vesey. Vesey was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the Reagan administration. Himself being a Minnesotan, he had many irregular meetings during the Reagan era in that club. I'd like to just touch on one organization that you probably never heard of, the Officers' Spouses Club. an organization today obviously made up, as the name implies, of mostly spouses from retirees, many of them guardsmen, who, as you know, if you're a guardsman, it's almost impossible to hold down a good job and plan a retirement because you're called up for 1 year active duty out of every 2 or 3 years. The women in the Officers' Spouses Club have collectively, on their own, raised over $40,000 to give to the families of people that have been deployed so that the soldier, man or woman, overseas can concentrate on his job rather than worry about the welfare of his family back home. If that club were to close, so would be the demise of the Officers' Spouses Club, which means that any future families in need would not be available to their benevolence. Ladies and gentlemen, that historic club has got to stay open. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. It was a great testimony, and the energy and your presentation just moves us to really picture this place and to really think about what is that we need to do. I don't know if the two of you know that this, the Fort Snelling, is located in my district. And I walk to it because it's the perfect walk from my house. It's about, you know, 2.5 miles. And it's a very, when you get there and you see all of these buildings, you can almost live this history that you're talking about. But it is very moving because you see the shape of these buildings, and it just, it almost brings tears to your eyes just to see the neglect that that these buildings are under, and how we've put some money just into keeping barely, you know, the buildings standing up. So we need to do a lot more. And Senator Stumpf, who is the chair of the bonding committee, really would like to do more to put some funding into these buildings. But it's a very complicated thing. Although it's located in my district, this is territory that doesn't belong to anyone, so then it's everybody's. But then we have to do more to put funding into this. So thank you. Members, do you have any questions for the testifiers or the senator? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, thank you for your service, gentlemen. I would be, I have the highest respect for those that have served our country and kept our freedom. With that, I look at this building, and my understanding, and if you can help me, is this is on federal land. Is that true? Okay, you're seeing the nods, yes. And
yes.
And it's also a military building?
The 934th Air Force Reserve has responsibility, and the partialing up, Madam Chair, of Fort Snelling, it came to the Army, the Air Force Reserves. It's their property. They manage it.
What is confusing is the fact that when the freeway was built, it separated the ground of that's now the Officers Club from the original fort.
Okay, and one, Senator Madam Hall. Chair, if I might. The Officers Club, as I understand it, is not just for officers. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay. Good.
It was an, originally just for officers until about a year or two ago when they started admitting non-commissioned officers and enlisted men to the club. This is the scenario that's going on in all the military clubs of all the services around the country. They're going from officers' clubs to, pardon the expression, all-hands clubs, where all military people are invited to use them.
I think that's great. And, Madam Chair, do we have the cost and what this is going to cost?
This is a resolution.
No, there is no cost because it depends on what's done.
Senator.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hall, what the resolution does is basically ask the federal government to be a partner with us in maintaining this piece of heritage here in Minnesota. So I think what the gentleman here and the other author are trying to do is sort of raise the flag on a potential either closing or abandonment as you heard earlier, occurred with the chapel for several decades. And, you know, what the resolution attempts to do is head that off before we might end up down that path.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my last question is, why are you not doing what you did with the chapel and putting together a 501c3 foundation to pay for this?
That may well be at some point in time, but right now the more critical thing is to get the recognition of the Officers Club as a historic site. The chapel bears that. It is a historic site. And so in the case of the state, SHPO is responsible for approving any modifications to that historic site. But right now it's under the Air Force Reserve, and does not bear that status. It could probably open a number of new avenues or doors for funding if it had that good housekeeping seal as a historic site.
And Madam Chair, sorry, I said that last one was my last question, but it brought another thought. You understand that, at least my understanding, if you make this a historic site, that will limit you to what you can probably do with it, that you can only do what it was, not expand it, possibly. There are some limitations to that.
Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions, members? If not, Senator Johnson, moves that Senate file 1828 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you,
Madam
gentlemen.
Chair,
thank you, Senator.
Members.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next in the agenda, we have Senate File 1419, Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I just want to make it clear from the beginning that our goal and my goal here from the beginning has been to ultimately strengthen our ethnic councils so that they can more effectively advise the legislature on issues that are of concern to their communities. In general, the OLA report last year said that the councils were not well integrated into policymaking, had no clear statutory purpose, had not done a good job identifying objectives and outcome measures, had problems with meeting attendance and timely gubernatorial appointments. The OLA recommended four options, and my option is the response to number one, which is to clarify their purposes and require operational changes. I think it's important to keep the councils. When people engage together on issues, collaborate on solutions, they and their communities are strengthened and find a place in our democratic process. They then both trust government more because they're engaged with it and become more a living part of it. This is especially important as we welcome new immigrants from Asia, Africa, Latin, and South America to our state. The bill does put three councils into one statute, but that's because although their constituencies are different, their legislative purpose is the same. The bill, following the advice of the OLA to narrow and focus the duties of the councils, does that. It has a new overall mission of working for the implementation of economic, social, legal, and political equality for its constituencies, and there are four duties. The first one is to advise us about issues confronting their constituencies. And it's been amazing how I've been here a long time, so I remember when this place was largely a white Anglo place. And I'm just amazed every year as I see more and more constituencies from different ethnic communities here on lobby days, here advocating for bills. So I think that's important that the council really be in the middle of that, the councils. Second, to advise us about legislative and administrative changes needed to help improve economic and social conditions, to advise us about the implications and effects of changes we are proposing, which means to be here and comment on our legislation, and to be a liaison between us and organizations in their communities. This bill also brings accountability. The councils must have a strategic plan They must have achievable objectives, action steps, and measurable outcomes each year, with a report on the measurable outcomes for that year and what they plan to accomplish in the following year. The success of a diverse group of people working together depends on good leadership. So the executive directors now would be hired by the Legislative Coordinating Commission. They would be hired by them and have performance reviews. Right now, a layperson board hires an executive director who is then a state employee at the managerial level. Hence, the executive directors are representative of the state. If sued, it is the state that is sued, but the state has no influence or responsibility over this person. This is not a good situation. Under this bill, the hiring and performance reviews will be in consultation with the councils, but the LCC, the Legislative Coordinating Commission, will be in charge of the hiring process. The LCC are legislators. They're both bipartisan from both parties, and they're bicameral from the House and the Senate. They're headed by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. I think this connection with the LCC will also make a stronger connection between the councils and the legislative branch. Although the councils will still, the councils will be connected to the legislative branch, but the executive directors will be executive branch employees as they are now. And he or she will work with the Department of Administration with their, I think it's called their SMART program, to manage the operation of the council. The other details in this bill include duties listed for board members, so we expect them to be a working board. It includes legislative members that have voting rights, so that they will also become more active members. And the executive directors and legislative members can also offer advice, and where they're encouraged to offer advice to the governor on appointments to the councils, because as they're connected to their communities, they're in the best position to know who has the time and the energy and the expertise to assist the councils. That should help speed up the appointing process. There are other details in the bill for the operation of the councils with attendance requirements and term limits, training in open meeting laws, data privacy, parliamentary procedure, and then a way to transition from the old situation to the new. In conclusion, I strongly support retaining the ethnic councils with the revisions in this bill. I think we still have too many disparities in our society, and we need the help of these communities in working for more equity. And I truly believe that the communities can't solve the disparities without our help, and we can't do it without their participatory role. Change can be challenging, and I know that people are nervous about change. But change in these councils is imperative. I think that if we're not willing to reform, then we're at risk, because councils that have existed for 30, 40 years without any reform ever are in a very tenable position. So it's my belief and my hope that with these changes, the councils will continue and can carry out their responsibilities and their statutes more effectively. Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, I forgot to mention that I do want to, I have an author's amendment, and that's the A4 amendment. So I would move the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Senator. I think you have a copy of the A4 amendment in front of you. Some of the changes were adopted in the House, correct, Senator? That puts kind of the
some changes that were adopted in the House, some things that the our council recommended as well.
Members, any questions? Senator Hall?
Thank you, Madam
This
Chair.
Is an author's amendment, the A4 amendment. That puts the bill in the shape I'd like it in.
Let's pass it.
All of those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, on line 4.13, you talk about the attendance participation of members of the council. And I think that my concern is we've heard in the past that members don't show up and they're not participating. Do we have any way of keeping either track of that or results if, you know, a member doesn't show for the, you know, for it?
Senator Pappas?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Hall, yes, of course. They keep minutes and attendance of all their meetings. And there is a provision in here, which Ms. James might have to help me find, that for removal of council members, I believe if they miss three meetings in a row, that then they can be removed.
Okay. I like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, Senator, you have several testifiers that are ready to step in. I have a few names in here, and I want to remind the audience we really would like to hear your testimony and your thoughts and feedback on the language that is being proposed. As Senator Pappas has stated, we value the councils. We value the opportunity to hear your thoughts as to how American Indians and people of color need to be included in the process. But we are here to have a discussion about this particular language. So please make sure that your remarks address the specific language that is before you.
Madam Chair, could I just mention one thing?
Senator Bubbs.
Yes, I have not made any changes with the Ombudspersons Program. I think that in previous testimony there was a desire to look at some changes there, and I certainly think that Madam Chair, myself would be very open to doing that, but that is not included in this bill.
That is correct, Senator Pappas, and I think the Ombudspersons are here in the board to testify. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, and Senator Pappas, am I right in my understanding that the American Indian is not included in this, and can you tell us why?
Senator Bubbs.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, because of sovereignty issues, their board is made up of the chief executive officers, the tribal chiefs of all the Indian tribes in the state, and so they're sovereign nations. So I think that if we feel that there needs to be reform with the Indian Affairs Council, that we need to tell them that they need to come up with their own proposals. So although they are advisory to the legislature as well, and they're funded by the legislature, because of their unique situation as sovereign nations, I didn't feel like it was in our purview to include them in this reform proposal.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, then we're still giving them money, but we're not asking anything from them. Is that what you're telling me?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, we certainly would like input from them. For example, the bill that we passed here the other day on creating a Indigenous Peoples Day, the second Monday in October, we did consult with the Indian Affairs Council, and they were here, and they did testify that they were in support of that bill. So they are still here at the legislature. We encourage them to be here commenting to have, you know, similar statutory duties as these other councils do, but they're not included in this reform proposal.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Tao is here, Ms. Herr, Ms. Hill, and Mr. McDonald. So if you could please approach the table.
Maybe
and,
we could take the
identify.
First two at a time okay. that you mentioned.
So we have Mr. Tao and Ms. Herr. If you could please, welcome to our committee. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Honorable Madam Chair, the committee members. My name is Dai Tao. I'm the St. Paul City Council in Ward 1. On behalf of myself, my constituents, I first of all want to thank each and every one of you for your leadership and your incredible work moving our state forward. I come to you before you today to seek your support of Senate File 1419 because as an immigrant and a person of color, I think it's extremely important to have gender balance and representation of the most underserved and marginalized members of the Asian Minnesotan community on the council. For example, the Karen, the Tibetan, the Hmong, and some of the Christian Burmese who have been oppressed for decades, who never had a voice in government, having an equal voice and power on the council means the world to them. We can't take away this opportunity for them to take ownership of responsibility to make our state one of the best for all communities, where all communities can progress. There's a recent study from the report from the Asian American Justice Center that on education, poverty, and I have a copy of that I can make available for you all, but I want to just highlight that some of the top earners in the Asian community in terms of earn per capita, the Taiwanese, the Indian, Malaysian, Japanese, and they're some of the most successful Americans we have in our country. And then I just want to contrast that with the Cambodian, the Hmong, the Laotian, the Vietnamese. They are at the bottom. And so when we are talking about Asian American, we have to really look at what's behind the numbers. We can't lump them all together in terms of income per capita. And I just also want to highlight in terms of poverty rates in the United States, between 2007 and 2009, the Hmong are at 26%, the Bangladesh 20%, the Cambodian, the Pakistanis are 15 and 18%, while the Japanese, Indian, and Filipino are at 6, 8, and another 8%. And so I think we have to be really careful about if we, because my understanding is that there is another bill in the House that would combine the different councils of color together, and I think that's a noble idea, but I think that I also feel that during this time, it's probably not a good idea to eliminate some of the underrepresented and community from government and from the council. This is really a time to embrace all the different diverse group that we have, and that diversity is our strength. And so I think that with the bill that Senator Papp is trying to move forward, I think it's good for all the Asian community, and that to specifically for the Council of Asia Pacific and so on, we should have, it should be for the people, by the people that it's supposed to represent, and not just by the affluence and the well-established group and our state. And so I come before you to ask for your support in pushing this bill forward. I know that it's not it may not be the perfect, but you know, we don't know what that is. So this is really an experiment, but I think the changes that are being proposed and amended, it will give us a huge amount of opportunity for us to engage the different community so that they can take responsibility for our state and the progress that we'll make together. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Tao. I'm going to repeat. We have heard these testimonies before. It's been a 2-year really looking into how we can work with the councils. I want the audience to know that we really want to preserve the councils. The issue that we are trying to figure out is what the actual construct of the council should be. So I really would like to make sure that the testifiers offer some light into what has been a very difficult conversation for us in the legislature as to how these new agencies should be structured. It's not whether or not we have the councils and we value the councils. It's whether or not the proposals that we have offered actually create the accountability and the governance model that is required for that representation today. So I am going to ask one more time to the testifiers to please give us a little bit more feedback into that process. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tao, I want to thank you for coming today. My question is, wondering if you would share with me how you would envision the process for the Legislative Coordinating Commission to appoint a director to the Council on Asian Pacific Americans.
The executive director or the
yes,
committee members?
The executive director, please.
Okay. You know, I think that I would leave that to be in charge of the board members. Who, if the board members feel that a director or a person is has the qualification, the understanding of the different community that he or she served, then I think that power should be left for them. I just want to caution about having for example, when we talk about education gap and economic gap, the narrative, the dominated narrative has been it's black and white. And so when we start lumping groups together, then sometimes we forget that there's folks in the middle that needs to be heard and needs to have opportunity in shaping our public policy.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dow, I wanted to try to rephrase what I said. My concern and what I'm asking for you is how you would envision this. See, the Legislative Coordinating Commission appoints the executive director, not the board. And I'm wondering how you would envision the Legislative Coordinating Commission.
Madam Chair, perhaps I could address that, because I don't know that Mr. Tao is that familiar with the bill.
Senator Papp, okay, Mr. Tao supports this language, and I think it's important that I think my understanding from his answer is that he believes that the board is going to hire the director.
Exactly.
So I think it's very important that he articulates how he envisions this hiring process.
Madam Chair, so I will speak on how I think will work, right? And how I think that there's opportunity for us to have that community, that conversation, but with those community in the room. And so I think that even though we have a process, we should still be involving the different communities that this council is supposed to represent. And so in order for government to work, or this council to work, it, part of that is to be what I believe seeing work is the grassroots effort and having them be part of the process.
Yeah. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out the language on 3.6. And the Legislative Coordinating Commission does this with a number of other commissions. The Legislative Coordinating Commission must establish a process for recruiting and selecting applicants for the executive director positions. This process must include consultation with the applicable council. So typically how Mr. Hubinger works, and he certainly could explain it to us, is that people submit their resumes. There is a staff screening process that goes on based on the qualifications. And I think the councils can be consulted with what the qualifications are that they're looking for in an executive director. So it's a kind of a objective process. And then a subset of the council could be involved in interviewing the various applicants for the position and then recommending to the LCC, which would then approve the final hiring process. But our problem is that, as I mentioned in my opening statements, is these are state employees. And so really, you know, state officials need to be in charge of the final decision-making and the oversight, but with very strong consultation from the volunteer advisory committees. And that's different than what we have now. But we, you know, we have boards that aren't trained in human resources, that aren't managers, that don't have any managerial experience. We'd like them to be trained in more of that and have kind of limited time to give to this voluntary job. And it hasn't worked very effectively in the past. So we're trying a new approach with more accountability.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Eaton, you know, we need to move and take testimony from other people. I just want to point out that it's very important that people who are testifying actually testify on the language. For me, you know, it's just clear to hear that when a testifier supports a process that is not clear, it is our obligation to clarify that. And so when Mr. Tao says, you know, the community will be involved in the hiring process, well, the bill is asking the Legislative Coordinating Commission to hire the executive director. So I think Senator Eaton's question was a very important question so that Mr. Tao actually, you know, can articulate his position on that. But Senator Eaton, and then we're going to move on. Senator Eaton.
You just said what I was going to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that we are moving forward, and I want to hear from all the folks too, but I do want it to be important that often we do have our testifiers that come over and that support a particular issue but don't know every single line of the bill. So I think we want to be respectful to our testifiers and let them know kind of what the process is, to the point that Senator Eaton went, and I'll reiterate what Senator Pappas has articulated, that there is a process that can involve community members that helps to advise who gets put forward to the Legislative Coordinating Committee in order to select the chair. So there is some grassroots input that Councilmember Tao has said that will inform it if Senator Pappas's bill becomes law.
Thank you, Senator. Absolutely. And, you know, we want to make sure we receive a letter also from a testifier saying we're very happy that these executive directors are going to be in the executive branch. So there is a lot of confusion, you know, as to how this process will work, and we want to make sure that out of this process people understand. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and this conversation has prompted some thinking on my part about, first of all, I want to say that many times legislators do not know everything that's in the bill and what is going on. So we're in a learning process with you. Secondly, I want to talk about the fact in this bill, Senator Pappas, that three out of four of the legislative appointees can dismiss a board member. Can you tell me why you why you chose to put that in your bill.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to do that, and then we should probably let the testifiers speak. If you have, you know, a friend that's on the board and they're not attending meetings and they're not participating, it can be very difficult and to make a decision to terminate them and from the board. And I think that legislators are maybe a little more used to having to make these tough decisions. So if three of the legislators feel that this particular board member is very disruptive and not participating and not kind of with the program for the council, then they can take on that responsibility as, you know, as voting members. We want a partnership here between the community and legislators. They can take on that responsibility to ask that board member to leave.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, follow up, and they will really move to testify.
And yes, Madam Chair, I'd really like to get this clarified because I would like to hear it from all of the councils, not just the Asian Council, but the Black. I would like the Council on Black Minnesotans to respond to what I think these two items are kind of distinctively different and important and so forth. So the reason a member who has missed more than half of the council meetings is automatically removed from the council. And then a member appointed by the governor may be removed by a vote for three of the four legislative members of the council. And I presume that would also then be a legislator who doesn't attend at least six meetings a month, a year, would be taken off the council. Is that correct?
Right, absolutely. Which Madam is very Chair, common, by the way. I'm in the council.
Right.
Yes, it is.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, we do want people to take this responsibility seriously, and we want it to be an engaged working board. And sometimes we're a little too Minnesota nice about that. And so this is putting some teeth into the legislation that say, yes, if you don't attend the board meetings and you don't participate in a constructive way, then your fellow board members can boot you off the board, including legislators.
Thank you. Senator, we're going to move senators into testifiers because we have a long list and it's expanding. So, Ms. Herr, please proceed with your testimony if you identify yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. I've come before you multiple times before, so for the record, I'll just state that my name is Sia Herr, and I am the executive director at the Asian Council. I will just repeat again that I've been in many of your offices, and today my purpose for being here today is simply to share with you that our board last Thursday voted overwhelmingly in support of Senate File 1419. But no matter which decision you take, I am here today to also just remind you about a few things as you go about making your decision to restructure the three ethnic councils. As I've said before, I've been in many of your offices. I try to represent all of our communities, and by that I mean that the Asian Council represents Minnesotans that descend from well over 42 nations. I try to give legislators and members of the executive branch both advice and access to our many communities. In the end, I personally and in my capacity as executive director believe that our council and I should not act as gatekeepers through which community members come to the legislature and legislators come to the community. Our council should help empower two-way open communication to and from our communities to the legislature and in reverse from the legislature to our communities openly. When I have traveled across Minnesota, I have seen our community members' desire to have a better relationship with the legislature, and I've seen legislators make sincere and serious outreach to community members in their district. I find this to be incredibly encouraging. But as all of you know, not all is perfect. The report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor was critical, in some ways scathingly critical of the councils, including ours. In addition to the findings that Senator Pappas identified earlier, the OLA report last year said, as it relates to the Asian Council, that we have not been addressing our statutory duties as an advisor, that instead we have been too busy engaging in cultural activities, and that we have not done a good enough job of engaging and informing our constituents. So I accept that there is need for substantive change, as does our board, And I commend Senator Torres Ray and Senator Pappas for bringing forward Senate File 1823 and Senate File 1419, respectively. As I said, our council voted overwhelmingly in support of Senate File 1419, and the reasons are that we believe that for our Asian Pacific community, a distinct council with our identity in the forefront, not consolidated with the other two councils, provides comfort and increases the odds that our members will find their way into the process. We believe that a managing board consisting of members of the community is still essential to creating a more welcoming and effective council. As it relates to a community of Minnesotans descended from more than 42 nations speaking over 100 different languages, these board members bring to the table a level of knowledge pertaining to cultural nuances and credibility that an executive director alone in the Department of Ethnic Affairs may never have. With Senate File 1419, we believe that the end result will be that our council will be more effective as an advisor and as an advocate. In a quest for effective policy, hopefully nonpartisan, if not bipartisan, I believe that it is critical our council exists to provide a means for community members to begin and to continue interacting with legislators and the rest of their government. Our staff at our council and our active board members have been pushing a limited but community-specific legislative agenda this session. One example of the work that our council has done is the two bills on gender-based violence as it relates to Asian women and children. This has been a result of the partnership between our council, legislators, local government, and community. Without the structure of our distinct council, these important bills would not exist, much less get a hearing. Without the structure of our current council, we would not have been able to approach the legislature with our ask of what we believe is truly a nonpartisan good policy agenda. I ask that you support Senate File 1419. In addition, I ask you to keep these few things that I've just shared with you in mind as you go about restructuring the three ethnic councils. As always, thank you for your time and for your interest in our communities, which truly are Minnesota's communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Hill and Mr. Ed McDonald, Mr. Garcia, Ms. Garay Lane. So we're going to take Ms. Hill next. Ms. Hill, I don't know if there are other ombudspersons in here or you're by, okay, if you would like to join and didn't know who else is here. Ms. Nanchu? Mr. McDonald, if you could allow the ombudspersons to, then I'll call you next. Senator Pappas, I want to make sure the ombudspersons asked to be given some time because they are tied to the council in the appointment process, and they wanted to have time to kind of explain how that works. And I, to the ombudspersons and the board members who are here, I would like to make sure, you know, we really appreciate the work that you do. We want to talk about the importance of having your voice on behalf of children of color, but I would like you to please, the testimony is about the bill and how you know, is there is an issue with respect to the connection to the councils, that you really connect your testimony to the bill that is in front of you. Ms. Hill.
Thank you. And good afternoon. My name is Ann Hill, and I'm with the Office of Ombudspersons for Families. I'm here to speak in opposition of this bill and to request that the committee lay over the bill until provisions for the Office of Ombudspersons for Families are included and that you get additional input from the communities. I also know that it's not supported by at least two of the consuls. And it complicates the relationship that the Office of Ombudspersons for Families has with the councils of color. This is not only a problem for me, but it's personal to me, because children are my business and children are our future. The Office of Ombudspersons for Families was created by legislature in 1991 with the input and support of the councils of color and community members. The purpose was to provide independent oversight of the child welfare system, to work with state, county, legislative policymakers to improve child welfare services, to improve the practice, to improve policies that would help eliminate disparities, and to result in better outcomes for children of color, poor children, and all children in Minnesota involved in the child welfare system. The Office of Ombudspersons for Families statute requires that we work in collaboration with the councils. And each ombudsperson has an administrative link to each council by way of a community advisory committee. Under 1419, unless this problem is fixed by delinking the Office of Ombudspersons for Families, this agency will essentially hang in limbo with no accountability. It is unfortunate that the creators of this bill neglected the critical connection between the Office of Ombudspersons for Families to the councils, particularly in light of the governor's task force on the protection of children and their release of their final recommendations, and in recent recommendations. Those recent recommendations require that we change and expand the role of the Office of Ombudspersons for Families. They also recommended that we rename our office, the Minnesota Office of Ombudspersons for Children and Families. They also recommended that we expand scope to include Minnesota children and families, all Minnesota children and families, that we include a specific reference to the reporting of the Maltreatment of Minors Act, that we require courts and social service and other social service agencies to alert us in the early stages of child protection investigation and assessment, and that we receive all notifications of children in need of protection and services. The task force also recommended that we convene a committee or work group specifically for the purpose of exploring the expansion and placement of the Minnesota Office of Ombudspersons for Families and our role to the oversight of child welfare services. Now, I understand that the legislative auditor's report recommends that some structural changes be made to the councils. However, my 25 years for working for the state of Minnesota, my active participation in other reorganization efforts and renaming of agencies' efforts like the Department of Education, my active participation in policy development and creation of the family service collaboratives and mental health collaboratives informs me that this bill will not fix the problem identified in the legislative auditor's report with respect to the consuls, and that, in fact, creates structural confusion for the Office of Ombudspersons for Families. And that would be unfortunate, given all the work and resources that the governor is now putting into child welfare services. I ask for your consideration of my concerns about this bill and how it will adversely impact the Office of Ombudspersons for Families, our operation, and our continuing oversight of children, Minnesota children, in the child welfare system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Madam Chair, it was actually quite a difficult job, as Madam Chair knows, to come up with a proposal to restructure the councils. And I think what Ms. Hill is talking about, it would be an incredible undertaking, and it sounds like a very important work to be done. I don't believe that this bill changes anything with the relationship right now, as problematic or as imperfect as Ms. Hill may think it is, between the Ombudsman's office and the councils. And certainly her advice in terms of how that might be restructured would be welcome, and I'm sure any number of us would be happy to work with her. But you know, at this point in the stage of the session, I think to look at more extensive restructuring would be very problematic. But perhaps if Ms. Hill wants to work with some of us over the interim, we could come up with. I know that Madam Chair had more conversations with the Ombudsman, and I'm sure she'd be willing to work with you over the interim.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Yes, I do appreciate Ms. Hill. I also neglected to, in my first round, to include the ombudspersons in my bill. And it was not until Ms. Hill attended the meetings at the Roy Wilkins Center that I realized that the link was so important, and we included in those conversations then the concept of ombudsperson, because we realized that they are so closely connected. We have two more testifiers from the Office of Ombudsperson. If you could briefly Ms. Nenchu and Ms. Garad-Lane provide your testimony so that we can put this ombuds concept. Thank you, Ms. Hill. We really appreciate it.
I have a question to Ms. Hill.
Senator Hayden.
Or to Senator Pappas, either or. Maybe it's more to Senator Pappas. So, Senator Pappas, in the event that your bill would move forward as written today, because I think that I'm a little confused, and I think it's a little confusing as the nature of the relationship to the ombudsman to the councils of color. So if we did nothing, Senator Pappas, but pass your bill, what would happen to the Office of Ombudsman for Families and your from your perspective?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I can't pretend to be an expert on this, Senator Hayden, but I don't believe there would be any change. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Hill, yes, Ms. Hill.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, actually our accountability goes through the governance board of the consuls of the specific consuls. We're hired. It's really complicated, but we have had Attorney General's opinions on this. We have a community advisory committee that is appointed through the
councils.
Those community advisory committees hire us and can fire us, but at the point they hire us, they go into community advisory committee. It's really complicated. The problem was a problem before the senator's bill here, but we were still neglected. This is an important part of we were still neglected, and it's just going to complicate where we fit now and who can actually hire us, who can fire us, who can sign off on timesheets, that kind of thing.
So, it's Madam the nature Chair. Of the new board, Senator Hayden. Apparently, as the new board becomes only an advisory capacity, and they don't hire, they don't have the authority to hire and fire and supervise. So the ombudsperson's appointment process is not linked to the original structure. I think that's what we're beginning to understand. I myself wasn't aware of these distinctions and this authority of the councils. It's just that as I talk to the community, I begin to kind of realize that there is some complexity on the nuance of the change. So, you know, the more you open the conversation, the more you learn.
Well, I think that was the point, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. And I think, Senator Pappas, that also is probably, and I don't know, I haven't counted, I don't know where this, if this bill's going to move on, and if it does, I don't know where it's going to, but I imagine it has another stop in finance, I would expect. And at that point, I think we do need to get an opinion and figure out if they're linked, how do they become delinked, and what does that mean? Or if they're linked together, then does now the LCC become the group that appoints the community advisory group, or do we, because the community advisory group is somewhat problematic. I won't say they're problematic, but it poses the same question of what we're doing right now in restructuring the proposal to restructure the council is who should be that in that supervisory mode. I think those are things that we have to work out as this bill progresses, if it does.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it actually reinforces the problem we've had with the councils is that you have a volunteer committee that's providing oversight and managerial responsibilities over a state employee. Mm-hmm. And so that it probably would be clear if we did have Ms. Hill reporting to some other state employee that could be her manager. And so why don't we talk about that and work on that between here and Finance Committee?
You know that policy will not meet. This is our last committee. So the policy issue has to be dealt in this committee. So you know that. Senator, Mr. McDonald, again, Ms. Nenchu and Ms. Gray, if you would like to address issues just related to the ombudspersons and specifically on that, if you want to add anything. And Mr. McDonald, I will give you time.
No, it's fine, Madam
You
Chair.
Will have time. We've specifically put time for this deal because we know you wanted to talk, so... Ms. Nenchu and Ms. Garay, if you could approach the table, if you have anything additional with respect to this.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Gubasta, if you want to approach and say anything related to this. Again, you know, with respect to the language, if you can just limit your testimony to that. Ms. Nanchu, if you could identify yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bao Ningchu. I'm the ombudsperson for Asian Pacific Families for the last 17 years. My concern about this changing law, which consists of 15 voting members, if passed, would leave the office of ombudsperson with no appointing authority, because there would be no board chair from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotan to appoint this community-specific board for the ombudsperson for Asian Pacific Families. So this will greatly impact how the ombudsperson would carry out its statutory charge unless we can work together to get it resolved effectively and in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nanchu. Ms. Guasa.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Muriel Gubasta, and I am an ombudsman with the state agency, the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, working with Minnesota's Hispanic Latino families on child protection issues. And because my colleagues Ann Hill and Bao Ning Chu have already presented to you, I would simply like to say that as we move forward in making a decision on whether to de-link the Office of Ombudsperson for Families from the councils, that please to call upon us and engage us so we can have more thoughtful conversation regarding this issue. I think the other thing that is really important is because the recommendations were published yesterday from Governor Dayton's task force for the protection of children, that we need to seriously do what is recommended there, which is to convene a group of people to look at how it is that we can expand the Office of Ombudsperson for Families. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Guasta. Mr. McDonald. Oh, please. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Jill Kehaulani Esh. I'm the ombudsperson for American Indian Families. I'm just a little concerned from the standpoint of Minnesota likes to be number one in football and baseball, but right now Minnesota is number one in the largest for disparities for American Indian children in out-of-home placement in the entire nation. So as the ombudsperson for American Indian Families, that is what I work with. I'm just concerned for the American Indian families and children, and I do share in the concerns of the other ombudspersons as to how would I be able to do my job going forward as the American Indian, as the ombudsperson working for American Indian families.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, let me just clarify. Ms. James just reminded me that as we look at their statute, the new councils take over these responsibilities, and there will be a chair of the new council that then will appoint these advisory committees. And then to the woman from the Indian Affairs Council, that stays the same. There's no change there. The Indian Affairs Council still appoints the advisory board that then works with you.
Thank you. I think the issue is the Indian Affairs Council will continue. Yeah, there is no change on how the process with your appointment will continue.
Right.
That's correct. Thank you so much for your testimony. Please.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tanya Long, and I'm the chair of the American Indian Community Specific Board, and I'm glad that Senator Pappas just cleared that up. I do want to say this, though, that our board is very, very active, and we collaborate continuously, weekly, daily with the Indian Affairs Council. Our board also consists of me. I hold a BA and a JD. We have two other state employees who are on our board. We did recently hire the new ombudsperson, but we worked very closely with the Department of Administration in doing so. I have also, as a board member, undergone a lot of training through the administration and through the SMART program. I just wanted to say that as far as our board, we are very knowledgeable, very well trained, and very, very active with our board and our community, and with all our members being American Indian members of tribes, part of the sovereignty issue that Senator Pappas mentioned earlier, we like that connection the way it is and would like that to continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. McDonald, welcome to our committee. Mr. Garcia, please proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Edward McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans, and I would like to thank you and the committee for the great work you do here at the legislature, and also for allowing me to bring you comments from our Council Board of Directors. And my comments will be specific to 1419, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, I've appeared before this committee in the past on behalf of my council board, explaining to you that our council board support House File 1418. Let me repeat, House File 1418 and Senate File 1650, which is our council's community-driven legislation to expand the Council on Black Minnesotans' operations. The council's organization expansion legislation grew out of 2 years of planning, had begun before OLA appeared in our office 2 weeks after I had gotten hired to inform me that they were going to do a 10-year review. But nonetheless, we trudged ahead with evaluations with our community to determine how best to restructure our operations to best meet their needs. Today, everybody ideas, but our community ideas about strengthening their council is being heard before your committee. We have the answers for our community if you want to hear them. Madam Chair and committee members, our council expansion legislation builds on the greatest current state structure for civic engagement and advisement created by any branch of government in this nation to ensure participation of protected class people when underrepresentation and underutilization is realized. The state of Minnesota in 1980 created the Council on Black Minnesotans as a community control entity that serves to negate underrepresentation in state government administrative operations and legislative deliberations until underrepresentation is eradicated. This structure provides for a community control, collaborative relationship with state lawmakers and executive branch departments at the local community level and generate administrative and legislative recommendations that have statewide impact for Minnesotans of African heritage when necessary. One key component of this function, beyond advising the legislative and executive branch, is to monitor and recommend actions that improve affirmative action and equal opportunity compliance in state government operations and by extension in the marketplace. So to assure eradication of underrepresentation in government operations and disparities in the marketplace. Madam Chair and members, it has been reported that the 2013 OLA report and continuing disparities and underrepresentations are the foundations for this legislation. I would like to address these foundations. There is no OLA basis for Senate File 1419 as relates to the Council on Black Minnesotans because OLA's most recent financial audit of the council yield good results. The OLA program audit shows, as I presented before this committee in the past, improving management of our operations, improving oversight of finances, statutory duties being addressed, strategic planning has been implemented, our program and policy recommendations matches our constituents' priorities, and community leaders do not want to see us merged. Madam Chair, restructuring the council will not eradicate socioeconomic disparities. When you hear the ferocious cry for racial justice and equity, and the marketplace is proliferated with disparity reports, You are hearing from the marketplace that something is amiss with the administrative application of equal access and opportunity laws, not the council's. Madam Chair and committee members, our communities are asking for this state to commit to employing cultural agility in state government operations and by extension in the marketplace. Cultural agility is the employment of individuals and entities with cultural and linguistic competence to diversify an institution's professional base so congruent behaviors, attitudes, and policies can come together that enable effective work in cross-cultural situations, diverse cultural communities, and to reduce institutional isms. Minnesota has three laws that help achieve this, Madam Chair, if they are complied with administratively. The administrative application of Minnesota Statute 16C, which is procurement laws, 43A, which is our affirmative action laws, and the appropriate investment in 363A, which is our human right laws. This is where the rubber meets the road in terms of eradicating and preventing disparities. Madam Chair and committee, our governor of this great state did not retaliate against us by weakening our long-standing mandate to monitor and advise on improvements to procurement, affirmative action, and human rights laws when we reported to his policy officials that major concerns exist with the administrative application of our state procurement, affirmative action, and human rights laws, and by extension were fueling disparities in the marketplace. He took actions to address the concerns by doing the following and more. He issued an executive order to create a council he chairs to strengthen procurement administration and affirmative action. He recommended, and is being considered by this body, an increased investment in human rights enforcement. He hired an executive search person to focus on eradicating underutilization of protected class personnel and other important steps. Several of these historic actions are awaiting both bodies' approval. Madam Chair and Committee, we also introduced legislation that addressed this matter, but it will not get a hearing this year. If committee members are interested in our recommendations, as we are mandated to provide, particularly on how we can strengthen human rights enforcement, you can review House File 1364 and Senate File 889. Madam Chair and committee members, our major concerns with Senate File 1419 are as follow. The Council on Black Minnesotans will no longer be a community-controlled quasi-state agency because the legislation establishes three different reporting authorities for the Council in the House version of the bill. The Council Board will report to the Governor. The Executive Director will report to the Legislative Coordinating Committee. And all other council staff will be nestled in the executive branch, creating an administrative nightmare for, I'm not even really sure who in this regard. Second, it weakens the council's long-standing history of monitoring affirmative action, equal opportunity compliance, and state government operations, which seem to be a hidden retaliation for carrying out this mandate with regards to affirmative action and equal opportunity compliance. Minnesota Statute 181-934 prohibits that type of retaliation. The bill may facilitate disparate treatment of certain protected class communities because similarly situated councils are not being subject to these changes, i.e., the Disability Council, which also represent protected class people, have not been subjected to the scrutiny of the OLA audit or any of these reform structural issues. We're all similarly situated. The difference is that agency is run by a white administrator. The bill may create an unequal approach for protected class groups to participate in state legislative making process. Minnesota Statute 3603 and 36.035 clearly states that anyone can bring legislation forward, and it doesn't have to be pre-cleared by a legislative body for political feasibility. The bill as amended by Representative Lane, does not state any specific statutory purpose, which seemed to be at the essence of all the arguments we hear, that the councils have no purpose. For the councils, it established no statutory purpose for the councils, and it repeals the existing enabling statute, so there will be no statutory purpose for the LLC or the legislature or the executive branch to use to determine if we have met a statutory purpose. Finally, there is no foundation for the legislation other than to retaliate for our advocacy for strengthening equal opportunity in contracting, hiring, and curtailing the disinvestment in human rights enforcement. If the other councils, Madam Chair, want to be structured in this matter, we support them. But our community has spoken with House File 1418 and Senate File 1650. We just wish you would hear us so we can move forward helping to grow a stronger Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for your hard work here at the legislature and allowing for me to present the comments of my council board.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. I have Mr. Garcia and Ms. Garay Lane. Members, we have 10 minutes to finish. I really would like, I know I have other names of people who wish to testify, so if you could please restrict your comments to the language that is before us. And I don't know, Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, just a brief comment. This is not the House, and I'm not Representative Lane. Wanted to make that clear to Mr. McDonald. And I'm not even going to respond to the accusation of retaliation.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Pappas, I was going to respond the same way with motivation here. We don't do that around here, is go on motivation, so thank you for that.
Mr. Garcia, again, I would very much appreciate for the members of the audience who wish to testify that you please focus your testimony on the bill before you, not on the value of the work that you do, because this is precisely because we value your work that we are here in dedicating all of this time to really try to figure out how to address some of the issues that were brought before our attention by the legislative auditor. Mr. Garcia, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Senator Pappas, and thank you to the OLA for this opportunity for beginning a process of change, which Clark recommended to the OLA back in 2011 and to various legislators and the governor's office. So we are very excited about what can be the outcome of this effort. As an executive director, I report to the community council members who are appointed by the governor. And it is under their counsel and advice that I am making the statement that Clark cannot support SF 1419 in its current form. And we have noted for several years that the disparities which afflict the Latino and other minority communities and the American Indian communities are a threat not just to us, but to the whole state. And I think that's the issue at hand. It's not so much the executive director or the community council or our communities, but it is really the whole state and its future that is at stake here. And so our recommendation is that all actions and all bills be tabled until next year, when we have had an opportunity to exchange our perspectives. I don't think, judging from what has been told to us by our community and my council, present here in the vice chair, and Suyapa, who is our legislative committee chair, that we have not been heard. And I think that is what is at the core of the disparities and of the issues with this great bill, because it has a lot of great characteristics to it. But the feeling on the part of the community and the council is that their opinions have not been taken sufficiently into account. The very first meeting that I attended as executive director of CLAC back in 2010, I heard a Native American leader react to a proposal by the Department of Health saying, why don't you invite us to the table before you design the proposal that you're bringing to us today to sign onto? And I think that's basically what our community wants. We know that we are the ones experiencing the problem, but for that very same reason, we hold part of the solution to the problem. And that's what we would like to have you consider. We would like to work with Senator Pappas, with this committee, with the OLA, and have a task force that will study this very carefully so that it can be a joint decision. It doesn't really matter what the structure might be. We have nothing against the duties, and I would even welcome more duties similar to those in the bill that was introduced by Senator Torres Rey. But what we do not agree with is our lack of involvement in designing solutions when those solutions directly affect our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Garcia. Oh, by the way, this committee will be receiving from the revisor's office our recommendations on the task force that we recommend come together to design a fully inclusive set of solutions to this matter. And I was also reminded that last year we submitted a bill through Representative Slocum and Senator Nelson that never got any traction, where we had proposed a trilateral body within the council representing the executive, the legislative, and the community. But it was never heard. So we hope this proposal for a task force will be heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. If to the testifiers at the table, if you could please, you know, identify yourselves quickly and then proceed with your testimony. You can start in any order, if you, Ms. Suyapa, if you want to, or Ms. Garay-Lane, if you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, distinguished members of this committee. My name is Alma Garay-Lane, and I'm a former board member, chair, and 45 years living in this community. So, as you know, I know this community inside out. Today, I am talking in my behalf, and I can say I can talk for my community. We do not support Senate File 1419. Why? Because I haven't heard that this there has been meetings getting the grassroots involved in that. We have to remember this is my community, or our community, for the communities of color, and we have the right that we have earned to be part of the solution, be part of the conversation to what is going to be the future of any agency that pertaining to us. We're not invisible. We're no longer invisible. When I came here 45 years ago, yes, we were, but no longer invisible. And we have a voice, and we would like for their voice to be heard. We want to be part of the solution, not the problem. But we want to be in the table. And I realize that this is a short time for make any recommendations. I respectfully ask once again to table this until all the parties involved have been heard and they can bring their concerns to the table. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If there's any question, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Araya. We certainly appreciate that you're here, and thank you for your service to the community. Either of the testifiers, if you could please introduce yourself. And
my name is Uriel Perez Espinosa. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee, and Sandy Pappas. Thank you for presenting the bill. I'm just here to support our director. I'm the vice president of CLAC currently. Thank you.
Thank you.
So my name is Siapa Miranda, and I'm here also to support CLAC, and I sit as the vice chair, the past vice chair on CLAC, and sit as the chair for legislative committee right now. And I also support CLAC as it sits right now.
Thank you, Ms. Miranda.
Madam Chair.
We have Senator Pappas.
The testifier is done.
No.
Oh, okay.
We have Ms. Ruby Lee and Ms. Nancy Hilden are also wishing to testify. Please,
thank you.
If you could approach the table.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will try to be brief, although this is an interesting time, but I appreciate the time. And Senator Pappas, thank you for the leadership and proposing language. I think that all of us have great intentions and really look forward to the opportunity to help the consuls be effective and more involved, I guess, in state government. My name is Ruby Lee. I'm president of CLUS. CLUS is the largest Latino agency in Minnesota, serving about 15,000 people annually. Before coming to CLUS, I worked in the 80s. In the decade of the 80s, I worked at the consul, the Latino consul, for 11 years. So I do have some background and memories of what the consuls certainly can do in the community. And I also worked in philanthropy in many issues dealing with undoing racism and undoing poverty. Briefly, I'm not really in support of Senate File 1419 for a couple of reasons. One, I don't believe the language provides sufficient clarity to the roles and responsibilities and the accountabilities that the consuls have. Having been in those shoes, having worked in the Latino Council, and I cannot speak for the other councils, of course, but having been in those shoes, I know that if you're not clear about your policy and your accountabilities in terms of how to be, in communication directly with the legislature, and the accountability, if you have to respond to the community, have to respond to many bosses. It is very complex, and I think that has been a challenge for the consuls. The other part of the bill that I also think that could be improved, or looking at other language that is being proposed at the same time, I believe that making the consuls accountable to the Legislative Coordinating Committee is just more of what we have been facing. I don't believe that the responsibility on the Legislative Coordinating Committee is really how I envision the participation of people of color in providing our voices and bringing them to the table. I believe that we have venues and we have ways in which we can do this, and putting the power in communities to be able to provide that information. Rather, having the decision making and elevating the power of the consuls and elevating the leadership of the consuls at an equal level as a State Department would help provide that. I also understand that some of my brothers and sisters from other communities of color are really concerned about coming together under one umbrella. My understanding, and we're not here to discuss the other proposals, but my understanding is that the other proposals are not necessarily putting the consuls under one umbrella. Each consul would remain with its own autonomy, and each consul would remain with its own leadership. At the same time, I can tell you as the president of the largest Latino agency that today I am working with other communities of color so that our voices can be more effective. We have the Emerging Workforce Coalition, in which we're advancing
the communication and looking at the disparities that we're facing in employment currently as communities of color. I am working with another coalition of people of color around housing, in advancing the home ownership for people of color. As an organization by itself, the reality is that I cannot do it alone. I need to come with other voices. So I really feel that the councils going forward can keep their autonomy. It should keep their autonomy. That communities should keep their autonomy, of course. But at the same time, there is hope, obviously, that we can also work together in advancing our community concerns.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. We totally appreciate your presence here. Ms. Hilden, we totally appreciate your testimony. I believe you're going to speak on behalf of an agency. We would totally welcome your very short remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief, and I'll be specific to the language. And thank you, Senator Pappas. I represent the Hmong American Partnership, which is the largest Hmong refugee organization in the country. And Bao Vang, who's the leader of that organization, asked that I please comment on two provisions in the bill, the delete everything that wasn't available. I want to just point that out. It wasn't available, so I had to scramble to get this. So online.
It's not that different from H2. Right.
Okay, thanks. So composition of these councils is very important. And you'll notice that the composition, for example, of the Latino Affairs Council is different than how the composition is put together on the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans on lines 1.27 through 1.32 specifically is the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And the concern that Ms. Vang has is that this potentially underrepresents those Asian communities in the state that may have very strong needs to interact with the state. And so refugee communities and very poor communities may be underrepresented, and even though they have very large communities here in the state. So we would ask that some consideration be given to really thinking hard about how that is composed. And then the second item is on basically kind of refers to lines 4.23 through 4.31 on the reporting. And this is really kind of an ancillary to that. And it has to do with who these councils are accountable to. And she would ask that you please consider finding some ways to codify how the council will reach out and be accountable to the communities that they are serving as well. And I think there are some references suggesting that you would look to some community, but really codifying that more solidly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hilden. We totally appreciate it. I know that there are some other people who wish to testify. We need to leave the room. I'm going to take some members' comments, and then I am going to I don't know, Senator Pappas, if you would like to do some...
Just briefly.
Just brief comments. Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm up to about three or four amendments, and I just don't think this bill is ready for prime time, and I would really like to move to table it.
Okay. Is that a motion, Senator?
I would like to move to table the bill.
Okay. That's not a debatable motion.
And I'd also like a roll call, please.
Thank you, Senator. We will take a roll on tabling the bill.
Pappas?
No.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden?
No.
Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson? Scalzi?
No.
Thompson? Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wicklund?
Yes.
Okay. With 6 yes and 5 no's, the motion prevails. Members, we have to take action on a bill that we just moved a moment ago. There is a bill that, what number is this? This is 1786, Senator Eaton. Apparently, we moved this and we send it to the floor, and we are supposed to send it to finance. So there was an incorrect motion. So we would like to bring the bill back.
Can I remake the motion then?
Please.
I'd like to move that we pass Senate File 1786 and send it to finance.
All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you. Senators, thank you so much. Senator Hall, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me if you plan on taking up the confirmation for the Met Council Chair anytime soon?
Yes, Senator. We will take confirmations. We have to confirm, actually, all of that board, so it takes a tremendous amount of time. And I understand we have other confirmations we have to do. So we needed to move these bills in order to meet deadlines, and those confirmations do not have deadlines. So I postpone every confirmation until we put bills forward, and then we'll bring back after the break all of the confirmations and okay. other things that you might want to hear that do not have deadlines. So absolutely we will. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So I'm a little confused about the action we just took. So we had voted on your bill last week, I'm assuming. So that's the bill.
Are we talking about the councils?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So is that the position of this committee then, it's your bill?
Or no.
What's the standing of any changes related to the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report relating to the councils of color?
So the bill that I moved forward originally had a lot of support, and for some reason the House decided not to hear it. The chair did not give me a chance to have a hearing in the House. Therefore, my bill never had an opportunity to be vetted in the House. The Senator Pappas's bill moved forward in the House, so we needed to bring it forward in the Senate. The community obviously was here expressing their concern. There are some issues in both bills with some technical issues that we need to address. And my view of it, Senator Scalzi, is that we needed to really bring the communities on board into this conversation, and we didn't. I plead guilty of that myself. I attempted to have that, and I corrected some of the issues around the ombudspersons quickly. I attempted to do the governance piece, but unfortunately, the House did not want to entertain the creation of what they call a new agency, which it never was. The idea that these councils come together was also a problem for the community. So there has been... we needed time to be able to put these pieces together. And I think the main issue right now is the governance piece and how this ultimately comes together. So we, with the motion that we took today, we just have to continue to do the work. I want to make a commitment to you before we adjourn. It's unfortunate that people leave without resolutions. This is typically the case. We either make a resolution that creates, remember, for me, this is 27 years. The Council on Indian Affairs is 52 years old, and the other councils are 30, 40. We must have a conversation that is more constructive than what we have had. I want to make a commitment to you that I am going to engage in this. People ask me to form a task force in order to have a conversation. I don't need to have a task force in order to have this conversation. As a chair of this committee, I can convene you anytime you want, and I hope that in the fall we take the time to come. I would like to have multiple hearings. I do want to address the issue of American Indian communities because I believe it is very important that we have their voices. I believe that we can do have a conversation with tribal members and with all of the representatives from those nations. It will require time, it will require your commitment, and it will require your really commitment to have this conversation. I hope that we can do this during the fall, and I hope we can bring a recommendation that we can move forward. This is not the end of the world. So that's my feeling, and I hope that I can bring bipartisan support so that we can move something in the House. I'd like to ask the chair to give me the chance to move this forward. But it seems like we run out of time to try to answer some of these concerns that people had in the community. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just feel that this was a close vote to table it. I feel that we unfortunately didn't have, we had a chance to vote on your bill. Mm-hmm. We did not have a chance to vote on this bill because of the tabling motion. And so we're just going to do nothing. So we've had passage in the House on one and passage in the Senate on the other, which puts us back to where we began. We've had a lot of testimony. This could be testimony to death. We have a charge here as legislators, and we have a charge to make a decision to do the proper thing in a legislative manner for the state of Minnesota. I just think that we were shortchanged by tabling a bill that we've had a lot of testimony on both sides. I just disagree with that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I'd like to speak to that since you're not able to debate when you table something. I'd like to explain the reason I did. I'm up to six amendments. There are some serious flaws in this plan. I am not comfortable with how many pieces are written. If three legislators don't like one of the board members on the council, they can throw them off. Board members don't get to vote on it, just the legislators. Board members can't remove legislators, or they can't remove each other. That's just one piece of many, many issues in this bill that I cannot live with. I think a lot of it was insulting to the communities that they are unable to make their own decisions in a lot of issues. The LCC can elect somebody that they don't that the council says they don't want. There's nothing in there that says that they have to listen to the councils. You would like to think they would, but people are people. So I have many, many, many concerns. It was not done flippantly or without great thought. I sat through all these too. I'm hoping that we can come to probably more of a blending of the two and something that works for everybody.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with some of your thoughts. And I thought we could have done that here. Those are amendments that I think you might have found support on. But to delay it for a year or whatever is going to take massive work during the interim and coming back next year. And I just think that we could have voted on those amendments and we could have voted on the bill. We could have done our
we
work.
Could have.
And, you know, Senator Scalzi, I will respectfully disagree with the testimony being supportive or against. I think we had one person who was confused about what the bill said that came to testify, and that was so obvious to me. The rest of the individuals who were here were opposed to this. I don't know, as a person of color, for me, this is a very difficult thing to do. I cannot act on a decision when I have so many people coming to testify against. I have said to the communities, it's kind of an awkward thing because we have board members of an organization that we're trying to restructure, so having them testify is kind of a conflict of interest. But as a person of color, it is quite difficult for me to be here and to listen and this then say, it really doesn't matter, I'm going to move because obviously I am a legislator and I can, and I have a vote and you don't. So I appreciate what is, I think, very unfortunate is that we have to make these decisions so fast and come together and change, you know, significant. I mean, this is a history of 50 years, and now we have to, in a few hours, come up with a decision to change it. So I do hear your frustration in that regard, Senator Scalzi, but I also hope that you do hear my frustration in terms of trying to figure out how do we bring the voices and really respect those voices, whether we think they are legitimate voices or not. Some of us may not think that these are legitimate voices. For me, they are. And sometimes I disagree with them, but they are legitimate voices nevertheless. I do disagree, and the community knows that I go on and say that I disagree, but I think I have to respect that process. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, and again, I could have maybe voted for Senator Pappas, but knowing that I also voted for yours, I don't think that either one was ready, and you've admitted that. So I voted to table it, knowing that you were also not going to pursue your bill in this particular session. We can't shove a policy down their throat if they don't have buy-in. It's just not going to work. So while we have talked it, we've really only seen legislation this year. I mean, I've sat on this committee for 3 years, and this is really the first time where we had overwhelming testimony on both sides of this issue. I don't think we've found the right bill yet. So I'm perfectly content I'm not necessarily keen on coming in the fall. But anyway, I'm perfectly content to have the discussion where all sides can get together that they can agree upon.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, hopefully we will not have to have a lot of hearings, but if some of us commit to have open hearings with the community and get, you know, the people who are interested in participating in this, then we will have to come back and make this decision. We have to make a decision. We cannot let this go without making a decision. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and I just want to say, because I've been on the Asian Pacific Council now for a little over 2 years, I really think the best thing in this bill, and it's something that I would fight for, is the training and support for the committees, because that is what I saw. Not that the board members that were there they were passionate about their issues, but they really, I think, had a lack of understanding of what their goal was, what their mission is, and how to deal with that. And it's not very difficult to understand. I mean, it's nothing that anybody couldn't learn if they were had spent some time. So this is a wonderful thing, and I would really hope that that will be in a bill that we put together at some point in the future. And I also say that I'm a strong believer in self-advocacy. And I don't think people who don't live that life really aren't the right people to determine real serious discussions or serious policies for the people that we're making changes for. And I include that not just the councils, but like I've been meeting with people with disabilities. I had a group of Muslim people came in, 15 of them from my district in Blaine, and they want to talk about what concerns them, not have me tell them what they should be concerned about. Self-advocacy is very important to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Johnson. And this is what will make this very challenging. This is not going to be an easy task, to go out into very diverse groups to say, how do we incorporate your voice into the work that we do? It cannot be because I said so. Because I do have the election certificate. I don't believe in that. I do represent a district, and I try to bring their voices, but I just don't think that I can say, because I have the certificate, I speak on behalf of Latinos. I just don't. I try, because I have some sensitivity, they trust that I speak on their behalf, but I don't. You know, there are 350,000 Latinos over there, and all of them actually live more in your district than they live in mine. So this is a very sensitive issue. For me, it's a lifetime commitment, and I hope that you can join in that process. I think the training is a very good idea, and we need to incorporate it. We need to adjourn very briefly, but we need to adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'd just like to offer you a report on evidence and research that we have done over the last 4 years for your consideration. I'll email it to you. You know, I don't have to take up your time, I would really appreciate it if you would read it, and I can come and testify at any point. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And with that, we will adjourn. Thank you very much, members.